after my cousin's sister Mira's wedding. That had been a big affair, too. Working in a tea shop, smashing coals, wiping tables. Bad news for me, you say. To break the law of his land, to turn bad news into good news, is the entrepreneur's prerogative. Tomorrow, Mr. Jobbow, starting again at midnight, I'll tell you how I gave myself a better education at the tea shop than I could have got at any school. Right now, though, it's time for me to stop staring at this chandelier and get to work. It is almost 3 in the morning. This is when Bangalore comes to life. The American workday is coming to an end, and mine is beginning in earnest. I have to be alert, as all the call center girls and boys are leaving their offices for their homes. This is when I must be near the phone. I don't keep a cell phone for obvious reasons. They corrode a man's brains, shrink his balls, and dry up his semen, as all of us know. So I have to stay in the office, in case there is a crisis. I am the man people call when they have a crisis. Let's see quickly if there is anything else. Any person having any information or clue about this missing man may kindly inform at CBI website, http://cbi.nic.in, email id diccbi@cbi.nic.in, fax number 011-230-11334, telephone number 011-230-14046, direct 011-230-15229, and 230-15218, extension 210, and to the undersigned at the following address or telephone number or numbers given below. DP 3687/05 SHO, Daulakwan, New Delhi, telephone 286-53200-2764-1000. Set into the text of the notice, a photograph, blurred, blackened, and smudged by the antique printing press of some police office, and barely recognizable even when it was on the wall of the train station. But now, transferred onto the computer screen, reduced to pixels, just an abstract idea of a man's face. A small creature with large, popped-out eyes and a stubby moustache. He could be half the men in India. Mr. Premier, I leave you for tonight, with a comment on the shortcomings of police work in India. Now, a busload of men in khaki. It was a sensational case after all. Must have gone to Laxman Garh when investigating my disappearance. They would have questioned the shopkeepers, bullied the rickshaw puller, and woken up the school teacher. Did he steal as a child? Did he sleep with whores? They would have smashed up a grocery shop or two and forced out confessions from one or two people. Yet I bet you they missed the most important clue of all, which was right in front of them. I am talking of the Black Fort, of course. I begged Kusum many times to take me to the top of the hill, and through the entranceway, and into the fort. But she said I was a coward. I would die of fright if I went up there. An enormous lizard, the biggest in the world, lived in the fort. So I could only watch. The long loopholes in its wall turned into lines of burning pink at sunrise and burning gold at sunset. The blue sky shone through the slits in the stone, while the moon shone on the jagged ramparts, and the monkeys ran wild along the walls, shrieking and attacking each other, as if they were the spirits of the dead warriors reincarnated, refighting their final battles. I wanted to go up there too. Iqbal, who is one of the four best poets in the world, the others being Rumi, Mirza Ghalib, and a fourth fellow, also a Muslim, whose name I've forgotten, has written a poem where he says this about slaves. They remain slaves because they can't see what is beautiful in this world. That's the truest thing anyone ever said. A great poet, this fellow Iqbal, even if he was a Muslim. By the way, Mr. Premier, have you noticed that all four of the greatest poets in the world are Muslim? And yet, all the Muslims you meet are illiterate or covered head to toe in black burqas, or looking for buildings to blow up. It's a puzzle, isn't it? If you ever figure these people out, send me an email. Even as a boy I could see what was beautiful in the world. I was destined not to stay a slave. One day Kusum found out about me and the fort. She followed me all the way from our home to the pond with the stones and saw what I was doing. That night she told my father. He just stood there gaping at the fort, just the way his mother used to. He is going to come to nothing good in life. I'll tell you that right now. When I was maybe 13, I decided to go up to the fort on my own. I waded into the pond, got to the other side, and climbed up the hill. Just as I was on the verge of going in, a black thing materialized in the entranceway. I spun around and ran back down the hill, too frightened even to cry. It was only a cow. I could see this from a distance, but I was too shaken up to go back. I tried many more times, yet I was such a coward that each time I tried to go up, I lost my nerve and came back. At the age of 24, when I was living in Dhanbad and working in Mr. Ashok's service as a chauffeur, I returned to Laxmangar when my master and his wife went there on an excursion. It was a very important trip for me, and one I hope to describe in greater detail when time permits. For now, all I want to tell you is this. While Mr. Ashok and Pinky Madam were relaxing, having eaten lunch, I had nothing to do, so I decided to try again. I swam through the pond, walked up the hill, went into the doorway and entered the black fort for the first time. There wasn't much around, just some broken walls and a bunch of frightened monkeys watching me from a distance. Putting my foot on the wall, I looked down on the village from there. My little Laxmangar. I saw the temple tower, the market, the glistening line of sewage, the landlord's mansions, and my own house, with that dark little cloud outside, the water buffalo. It looked like the most beautiful sight on earth. I leaned out from the edge of the fort in the direction of my village, and then I did something too disgusting to describe to you. Well, actually, I spat. Again and again. And then, whistling and humming, I went back down the hill. 8 months later, I slit Mr. Ashok's throat. The second night. For the desk of His Excellency Wen Jiabao, now probably fast asleep in the Premier's office in China. From the desk of His Midnight Educator on Matters Entrepreneurial. The White Tiger. Mr. Premier, so, what does my laughter sound like? What do my armpits smell like? And when I grin, is it true, as you no doubt imagine by now, that my lips widen into a devil's rictus? Oh, I could go on and on about myself, sir. I could gloat that I am not just any murderer, but one who killed his own employer, who is a kind of second father, and also contributed to the probable death of all his family members, a virtual mass murderer. But I don't want to go on and on about myself. You should hear some of these Bangalore entrepreneurs. My startup has got this contract with American Express. My startup runs the software in this hospital in London, blah, blah. I hate that whole fucking Bangalore attitude, I tell you. But if you absolutely must find out more about me, just log on to my website, www.whitetiger-technologydrivers.com. That's right. That's the URL of my startup. So I'm sick of talking about myself, sir. Tonight, I want to talk about the other important man in my story. My ex. Mr. Ashok's face reappears now in my mind's eye, as it used to every day when I was in his service, reflected in my rear-view mirror. It was such a handsome face that sometimes I couldn't take my eyes off it. Picture a 6-foot-tall fellow, broad-shouldered, with a landlord's powerful, punishing forearms, yet always gentle, almost always, except for that time he punched Pinky Madam in the face, and kind to those around him, even his servants and driver. Now another face appears, to the side of his, in memory's mirror. Pinky Madam, his wife. Every bit as good-looking as her husband, just as the image of the goddess in the Birla Hindu temple in New Delhi is as fair as the god to whom she is married. She would sit in the back, and the two of them would talk, and I would drive them wherever they wanted, as faithfully as the servant god Hanuman carried about his master and mistress, Ram and Sita. Thinking of Mr. Ashok is making me sentimental. I hope I've got some paper napkins here somewhere. Here's a strange fact. Murder a man, and you feel responsible for his life. Possessive, even. You know more about him than his father and mother. They knew his fetus, but you know his corpse. Only you can complete the story of his life. Only you know why his body has to be pushed into the fire before its time, and why his toes curl up and fight for another hour on earth. Now, even though I killed him, you won't find me saying one bad thing about him. I protected his good name when I was his servant, and now that I am, in a sense, his master, I won't stop protecting his good name. I owe him so much. He and Pinky Madam would sit in the back of the car, chatting about life, about India, about America, mixing Hindi and English together. And by eavesdropping on them, I learned a lot about life, India and America, and a bit of English, too. Perhaps a bit more than I've let on so far. Many of my best ideas are, in fact, borrowed from my ex-employer or his brother or someone else whom I was driving about. I confess, Mr. Premier, I am not an original thinker, but I am an original listener. True, eventually Mr. Ashok and I had a disagreement or two about an English term, income tax, and things began to sour between us. But that messy stuff comes later on in the story. Right now, we're still on best of terms. We've just met, far from Delhi, in the city called Dhanbad. I came to Dhanbad after my father's death. He had been ill for some time, but there is no hospital in Laxmangar, although there are three different foundation stones for a hospital, laid by three different politicians before three different elections. When he began spitting blood that morning, Kishan and I took him by boat across the river. We kept washing his mouth with water from the river, but the water was so polluted that it made him spit more blood. There was a rickshaw puller on the other side of the river who recognized my father. He took the three of us for free to the government hospital. There were three black goats sitting on the steps to the large, faded white building. The stench of goat feces wafted out from the open door. The glass in most of the windows was broken. A cat was staring at us from one cracked window. A sign on the gate said, Lohia Universal Free Hospital, proudly inaugurated by the great socialist, a holy proof that he keeps his promises. Kishan and I carried our father in, stamping on the goat turds, which had spread like a constellation of black stars on the ground. There was no doctor in the hospital. The ward boy, after we bribed him 10 rupees, said that a doctor might come in the evening. The doors to the hospital's rooms were wide open. The beds had metal springs sticking out of them, and the cat began snarling at us the moment we stepped into the room. It's not safe in the rooms. The cat has tasted blood. A couple of Muslim men had spread a newspaper on the ground and were sitting on it. One of them had an open wound on his leg. He invited us to sit with him and his friend. Kishan and I lowered father onto the newspaper sheets. We waited there. Two little girls came and sat down beside us. Both of them had yellow eyes. Jaundice, she gave it to me. I did not. You gave it to me. And now we'll both die. An old man with a cotton patch on one eye came and sat down behind the girls. The Muslim men kept adding newspapers to the ground, and the line of diseased eyes, raw wounds, and delirious mouths kept growing. Why isn't there a doctor here, Uncle? I asked. This is the only hospital on either side of the river. See, it's like this, the older Muslim man said. There's a government medical superintendent who's meant to check that doctors visit village hospitals like this. Now, each time this post falls vacant, the great socialist lets all the big doctors know that he's having an open auction for that post. The going rate for this post is about 400,000 rupees these days. That much? I said, My mouth opened wide.
Why not? There's good money in public service. Now imagine that I'm a doctor. I beg and borrow the money and give it to the great socialist. While touching his feet, he gives me the job, I take an oath to God and the Constitution of India, and then I put my boots up on my desk in the state capital. He raised his feet onto an imaginary table. Next, I call all the junior government doctors, whom I'm supposed to supervise, into my office. I take out my big government ledger. I shout out, "Dr. Ram Pandey!" He pointed a finger at me. I assumed my role in the play. I saluted him.
"Yes, sir."
He held out his palm to me. "Now you, Dr. Ram Pandey, will kindly put one-third of your salary in my palm. Good boy. In return, I do this." He made a tick on the imaginary ledger. "You can keep the rest of your government salary and go work in some private hospital for the rest of the week. Forget the village, because according to this ledger you've been there. You've treated my wounded leg. You've healed that girl's jaundice." "Ah," the patients said. Even the ward boys, who had gathered around us to listen, nodded their heads in appreciation. Stories of rottenness and corruption are always the best stories, aren't they? When Kishan put some food into Father's mouth, he spat it out with blood. His lean black body began to convulse, spewing blood this way and that. The girls with the yellow eyes began to wail. The other patients moved away from my father.
"He's got tuberculosis, hasn't he?"
the older Muslim man asked, as he swatted the flies away from the wound in his leg. "We don't know, sir. He's been coughing for a while, but we didn't know what it was." "Oh, it's TB. I've seen it before in rickshaw pullers. They get weak from their work. Well, maybe the doctor will turn up in the evening." He did not. Around 6 o'clock that day, as the government ledger no doubt accurately reported, my father was permanently cured of his tuberculosis. The ward boys made us clean up after father, before we could remove the body. A goat came in and sniffed as we were mopping the blood off the floor. The ward boys petted her and fed her a plump carrot as we mopped our father's infected blood off the floor. Kishan's marriage took place a month after the cremation. It was one of the good marriages. We had the boy, and we screwed the girl's family hard. I remember exactly what we got in dowry from the girl's side, and thinking about it even now makes my mouth fill up with water. 5,000 rupees cash, all crisp, new, unsold notes, fresh from the bank, plus a hero bicycle, plus a thick gold necklace for Kishan. After the wedding, Kusum Granny took the 5,000 rupees and the hero cycle and the thick gold necklace. Kishan got 2 weeks to dip his beak into his wife, and then he was packed off to Dhanbad. My cousin Dilip and I came along with him. We three found work in a tea shop in Dhanbad. The owner had heard good things about Kishan's work at the tea shop in Laxmangar. Luckily for us, he hadn't heard anything about me. Go to a tea shop anywhere along the Ganges, sir, and look at the men working in that tea shop. Men, I say, but better to call them human spiders that go crawling in between and under the tables with rags in their hands, crushed humans in crushed uniforms, sluggish, unshaven, in their 30s or 40s or 50s, but still boys. But that is your fate if you do your job well, with honesty, dedication, and sincerity, the way Gandhi would have done it, no doubt. I did my job with near total dishonesty, lack of dedication, and insincerity, and so the tea shop was a profoundly enriching experience. Instead of wiping out spots from tables and crushing coals for the oven, I used my time at the tea shop in Laxmangar to spy on every customer at every table and overhear everything they said. I decided that this was how I would keep my education going forward. That's the one good thing I'll say for myself. I've always been a big believer in education, especially my own. The owner of the shop sat up at the front, below the big photo of Gandhi, stirring a slow-boiling broth of sugar syrup. He knew what I was up to. Whenever he saw me loafing around a table or pretending to be doing a spot of wiping, just so I could hear more of a conversation, he would shout, "You thug!" Then jump down from his seat,
chase me around the tea shop with the ladle he had been using to stir the sugar, and whack me on the head with it. The burning syrup singed me wherever the ladle touched, and left a series of spots on my ears, which people sometimes mistake for vitiligo or another skin disease. A network of pink by which you can still identify me, although the police, predictably, missed it. Eventually, I got sent home. No one else in Laxmangar would hire me after that, even as a field hand. So it was mostly for my sake that Kishan and Dilip had come to Dhanbad, to give me a chance to start my career as a human spider afresh. In his journey from village to city, from Laxmangar to Delhi, the entrepreneur's path crosses any number of provincial towns that have the pollution and noise and traffic of a big city, without any hint of the true city's sense of history, planning and grandeur. Half-baked cities, built for half-baked men. There was money in the air in Dhanbad. I saw buildings with sides made entirely of glass, and men with gold in their teeth. And all this glass and gold, all of it came from the coal pits. Outside the town, there was coal, more coal than you would find anywhere else in the darkness, maybe more coal than anywhere else in the world. Miners came to eat at my tea shop. I always gave them the best service, because they had the best tales to tell. They said that the coal mines went on and on for miles and miles outside the town. In some places there were fires burning under the earth and sending smoke into the air, fires that had been burning continuously for 100 years. And it was at the tea shop in this city built by coal, while wiping a table and lingering to overhear a conversation, that my life changed. You know, sometimes I think I did the wrong thing in life, becoming a miner. Then, what else can people like you and me become? Politicians. Everyone's getting a car these days, and you know how much they pay their drivers? 1,700 rupees a month. I dropped my rag. I ran to Kishan, who was cleaning out the insides of an oven. After my father's death, it was Kishan who took care of me. I don't attempt to hide his role in making me who I am today, but he had no entrepreneurial spunk at all. He would have been happy to let me sink in the mud. "Nothing doing," Kishan said. "Granny said stick to the tea shop, and we'll stick to the tea shop." I went to all the taxi stands. Down on my knees I begged random strangers, but no one would agree to teach me car driving for free. It was going to cost me 300 rupees to learn how to drive a car. 300 rupees! Today in Bangalore I can't get enough people for my business. People come and people go. Good men never stay. I'm even thinking of advertising in the newspaper. Bangalore-based businessman seeks smart men for his business. Apply at once. Attractive remuneration packages on offer, lessons in life and entrepreneurship included for free. Go to any pub or bar in Bangalore with your ears open, and it's the same thing you hear. Can't get enough call center workers. Can't get enough software engineers. Can't get enough sales managers. There are 20, 25 pages of job advertisements in the newspaper every week. Things are different in the darkness. There, every morning, tens of thousands of young men sit in the tea shops, reading the newspaper, or lie on a charpoy, humming a tune, or sit in their rooms talking to a photo of a film actress. They have no job to do today. They know they won't get any job today. They've given up the fight. They're the smart ones. The stupid ones have gathered in a field in the center of the town. Every now and then a truck comes by, and all the men in the field rush to it with their hands outstretched, shouting, "Take me! Take me!" Everyone pushed me. I pushed back. But the truck scooped up only 6 or 7 men and left the rest of us behind. They were off on some construction or digging job, the lucky bastards. Another half hour of waiting, another truck came, another scramble, another fight. After the 5th or 6th fight of the day, I finally found myself at the head of the crowd, face to face with the truck driver. He was a Sikh, a man with a big blue turban. In one hand he held a wooden stick, and he swung the stick to drive back the crowd. "Everyone!" he shouted. Take off your shirts. I've got to see a man's nipples before I give him a job. He looked at my chest. He squeezed the nipples, slapped my butt, glared into my eyes, and then poked the stick against my thigh. Too thin. Fuck off.
Give me a chance, sir. My body is small, but there's a lot of fight in it. I'll dig for you. I'll haul cement for you. I'll...
He swung his stick. It hit me on the left ear. I fell down, and others rushed to take my place. I sat on the ground, rubbed my ear, and watched the truck leave in a big cloud of dust. The shadow of an eagle passed over my body. I burst into tears.
White Tiger! There you are!
Kashan and cousin Dilip lifted me up from the ground, big smiles on their faces.
Great news. Granny had agreed to let them invest in my driving classes.
There's only one thing, Kishan said. Granny says you're a greedy pig. She wants you to swear by all the gods in heaven that you won't forget her once you get rich.
I swear.
Pinch your neck and swear. You'll send every rupee you make every month back to Granny. We went into the house where the taxi drivers lived. An old man in a brown uniform, which was like an ancient army outfit, was smoking a hookah that was warmed up by a bowl of live coals. Kishan explained the situation to him. The old driver asked, "What caste are you?"
"Halwai."
"Sweet makers," the old driver said, shaking his head. "That's what you people do. You make sweets. How can you learn to drive?" He pointed his hookah at the live coals. "That's like getting coals to make ice for you. Mastering a car." He moved the stick of an invisible gearbox. "It's like taming a wild stallion. Only a boy from the warrior castes can manage that. You need to have aggression in your blood. Muslims, Rajputs, Sikhs, they're fighters. They can become drivers. You think sweet makers can last long in fourth gear?" Coal was taught to make ice, starting the next morning at 6. 300 rupees plus a bonus will do that. We practiced in a taxi. Each time I made a mistake with the gears, he slapped me on the skull. "Why don't you stick to sweets and tea?" For every hour I spent in the car, he made me spend 2 or 3 under it. I was made a free repair mechanic for all the taxis in the stand. Late every evening, I emerged from under a taxi like a hog from sewage, my face black with grease, my hands shiny with engine oil. I dipped into a ganja of black and came out a driver. "Listen," the old driver said when I was handing him over the 100 rupees he had been promised as a bonus. "It's not enough to drive. You've got to become a driver. You've got to get the right attitude, understand? Anyone tries to overtake you on the road, do this." He clenched his fist and shook it, "and call him a sister fucker a few times. The road is a jungle, get it? A good driver must roar to get ahead on it." He patted me on the back. "You're better than I thought. You are a surprise package, little fellow. I've got a reward for you." He walked, I followed. It was evening. We went through dim streets and markets. We walked for half an hour, while everything around us grew dark, and then it was as if we had stepped out into fireworks. The street was full of colored doors and colored windows, and in each door and each window a woman was looking out at me with a big smile. Ribbons of red paper and silver foil glittered between the rooftops of the street. Tea was being boiled in stalls by the sides of the road. 4 men rushed at us at once. The old driver explained that they should keep away, since it was my first time. Let him enjoy the sights first. That's the best part of this game, isn't it? The looking.
Sure, sure, the men said and stepped back. That's what we want him to do. Enjoy.
I walked with the old driver, my mouth open, gaping at all the gorgeous women, jeering and taunting me from behind their grilled windows, all of them begging me to dip my beak into them. The old driver explained the nature of the wares on offer. Up in one building,
sitting on a windowsill in such a way that we could see the full spread of their gleaming dark legs, were the Americans, girls in short skirts and high platform shoes, carrying pink handbags with names in English written on them in sequins. They were slim and athletic, for men who like the Western kind. In this corner, sitting in the threshold of an open house, the traditionals, fat, chunky types in saris, for those who like value for their money. There were eunuchs in one window, teenagers in the next window. The face of a small boy appeared from between a woman's legs and then vanished. A blinding flash of light, a blue door opened, and four light-skinned Nepali women in gorgeous red petticoats looked out.
"Them!" I shouted. "Them! Them! Them!"
"Good," the old driver said. "I like that, too. I always go for the foreign ones." We went in, and he picked a woman from the four, and I picked another woman, and we went into two rooms, and the woman I picked closed the door behind me. My first time. Half an hour later, when the old driver and I staggered back drunk and happy to his house, I put the coals in his hookah. I brought him the hookah and watched as he took a deep, contented suck on the pipe. Smoke came out of his nostrils.
"What is it now? I've taught you to be a driver and a man. What more do you want?"
"Sir, can't you ask the taxi men if they need someone? I'll work for free at first. I need a job." The old driver laughed. "I haven't had work in 40 years, you nitwit. How the fuck can I help you? Now get lost." So next morning I was walking from house to house, knocking on gates and on front doors of the rich, asking if anyone wanted a driver, a good driver, an experienced driver for their car. Everyone said no. You didn't get a job that way. You had to know someone in the family to get a job, not by knocking on the gate and asking. There's no reward for entrepreneurship in most of India, Your Excellency. It's a sad fact. Every evening I came home tired and close to tears. But Kishan said, "Keep trying. Someone will say yes in the end." So I went looking from house to house, house to house, house to house. Finally, after 2 weeks of asking and being told to get lost, I got to a house with 10-foot-high walls and a cage of iron grills around each window. A sly, slant-eyed Nepali with a white mustache peered at me through the bars of the gate. "What do you want?" I didn't like the way he asked that one bit. I put a big smile on my face. "Any need of a driver, sir? I've got 4 years' experience. My master recently died, so I..." "Fuck off! We have a driver already," the Nepali said. He twirled a big bunch of keys and grinned. My heart sank, and I was about to turn away when I saw a figure on the terrace, a fellow in long, loose white clothes, walking around and around, lost deep in thought. I swear by God, sir. I swear by all 36 million and 4 of them. The moment I saw his face, I knew. This is the master for me. Some dark fate had tied his lifeline to mine, because at that very moment he looked down. I knew he was coming down to save me. I just had to divert this Nepali fucker as long as possible. "I'm a good driver, sir. I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't steal."
"Fuck off, don't you understand?"
"I don't disrespect God. I don't disrespect my family."
"What's wrong with you? Get lost at once."
"I don't gossip about my masters. I don't steal. I don't blaspheme." Just then, the door of the house opened. But it was not the man on the terrace. It was an older man, with a big white mustache that was thick and curved and pointy at the tips.
"What is going on, Ram Bahadur?" he asked the Nepali. "He's begging, sir, begging for money."
I banged on the gate. "I am from your village, sir. I am from Laxmangar, the village near the Black Fort, your village." The old man was the stork. He stared at me for the longest time, and then he told the Nepali guard, "Let the boy in." Swoosh! As soon as the gate was open, I dived straight at the stork's feet. No Olympic runner could have gone in as fast as I did through those gates. The Nepali had no chance at all of blocking me. You should have seen me that day. What a performance of wails and kisses and tears. You'd think I'd been born into a cast of performing actors. And all the time, while clutching the stork's feet, I was staring at his huge, dirty, uncut toenails and thinking, what is he doing in Dunpart? Why isn't he back home, screwing poor fishermen of their money and humping their daughters? Get up, boy, he said. Big, uncut toenails scratched my cheeks. Mr. Ashok, the man on the terrace, of course, was by his side now. You're really from Laxmangar? Yes, sir. I used to work in the tea shop, the one with the big photo of Gandhi in it. I used to break coals there. You came once to have tea. Ah, the old village. He closed his eyes. Do people there still remember me? It's been 3 years since I was there. Of course, sir. People say our father is gone. Thakur Ramdev is gone. The best of the landlords is gone. Who will protect us now? The stork enjoyed hearing that. He turned to Mr. Ashok. Let's see how good he is. Call Mukesh, too. Let's go for a spin. Only later did I understand how lucky I'd been. Mr. Ashok had come back from America just the previous day. A car had been bought for him. A driver was needed for the car. And on that day, I had turned up. Now, there were two cars in the garage. One was your standard Maruti Suzuki, that little white car you see all over India, and the other was the Honda City. Now, the Maruti is a small, simple fellow, a perfect servant to the driver. The moment you turn the ignition key, he does exactly what the driver wants him to. The Honda City is a larger car, a more sophisticated creature, with a mind of his own. He has power steering and an advanced engine, and he does what he wants to. Given that I was so nervous then, if the stork had told me to take the driving test in the Honda City, that would have been the end of me, sir. But luck was on my side. They made me drive the Maruti Suzuki. The stork and Mr. Ashok got into the back. A small dark man, Mukesh Sir, the stork's other son, got into the front seat and gave me orders. The Nepali guard watched with a darkened face as I took the car out of the gates and into the city of Dhanbad. They made me drive them around for half an hour and then told me to head back. Not bad, the old man said as he got out of the car. Fellow is cautious and good. What's your last name again?
Halway.
Halway. He turned to the small dark man. What caste is that? Top or bottom? And I knew that my future depended on the answer to this question. I should explain a thing or two about caste. Even Indians get confused about this word, especially educated Indians in the cities. They'll make a mess of explaining it to you. But it's simple, really. Let's start with me. See, Halwe, my name means sweet maker. That's my caste, my destiny. Everyone in the darkness who hears that name knows all about me at once. That's why Kishan and I kept getting jobs at sweet shops wherever we went. The owner thought, ah, they're Halwes. Making sweets and tea is in their blood. But if we were Halwes, then why was my father not making sweets but pulling a rickshaw? Why did I grow up breaking coals and wiping tables, instead of eating gulab jamuns and sweet pastries, when and where I chose to? Why was I lean and dark and cunning, and not fat and creamy-skinned and smiling, like a boy raised on sweets would be? See, this country, in its day of greatness, when it was the richest nation on earth, was like a zoo, a clean, well-kept, orderly zoo. Everyone in his place, everyone happy. Goldsmith here, cowherds here, landlords there. The man called the Halwe made sweets. The man called the cowherd tended cows. The untouchable cleaned feces. Landlords were kind to their serfs. Women covered their heads with a veil and turned their eyes to the ground when talking to strange men. And then, thanks to all those politicians in Delhi, on the 15th of August 1947, the day the British left, the cages had been let open, and the animals had attacked and ripped each other apart, and jungle law replaced zoo law. those that were the most ferocious, the hungriest, had eaten everyone else up and grown big bellies. That was all that counted now, the size of your belly. It didn't matter whether you were a woman or a Muslim or an untouchable. Anyone with a belly could rise up. My father's father must have been a real halwai, a sweetmaker. But when he inherited the shop, a member of some other caste must have stolen it from him with the help of the police. My father had not had the belly to fight back. That's why he had fallen all the way to the mud, to the level of a rickshaw puller. That's why I was cheated of my destiny to be fat and creamy-skinned and smiling. To sum up, in the old days, there were 1,000 castes and destinies in India. These days there are just 2 castes, men with big bellies and men with small bellies. And only 2 destinies, eat or get eaten up. Now the dark man, Mukesh Sir, brother of Mr. Ashok, did not know the answer. I told you that people in the cities know nothing much about the caste system, so the stork turned to me and asked me directly, "Are you from a top caste or bottom caste, boy?" I didn't know what he wanted me to say, so I flipped both answers. I could probably have made a good case either way, and then said, "Bottom, sir." Turning to Mukesh Sir, the old man said, "All our employees are top caste. It won't hurt to have 1 or 2 bottom castes working for us." Mukesh Sir looked at me with narrowed eyes. He didn't know the village ways, but he had all the cunning of the landlords. "Do you drink?" "No, sir. In my caste, we never drink." "Halwai," Mr. Ashok said with a grin, "are you a sweet maker? Can you cook for us while you're not driving?"
"Certainly, sir. I cook very well. Very tasty sweets. Gulab jamuns, laddus, anything you desire," I said. "I worked at a tea shop for many years."
Mr. Ashok seemed to find this amusing. "Only in India," he said. "Your driver can also make sweets for you. Only in India. Start from tomorrow."
"Not so fast," Mukesh Sir said. "First we have to ask about his family. How many are they? Where they live? Everything. And one more thing. How much do you want?"
"Another test." "Absolutely nothing, sir. You're like a father and mother to me, and how can I ask for money from my parents?"
800 rupees a month," he said.
"No, sir, please, it's too much. Give me half of that. It's enough. More than enough."
"If we keep you beyond 2 months, it'll go to 1,500. Looking suitably devastated, I accepted the money from him.
Mukesh Sir was not yet convinced about me. He looked me up and down and said, "He's young. Don't we want someone older?"
The stork shook his head. "Catch 'em young and you can keep 'em for life. A driver in his 40s, you get what, 20 years of service? Then his eyes fail. This fellow will last 30, 35 years. His teeth are solid, he's got his hair, he's in good shape."
He sucked on his betel juice, which was filling up his mouth, turned and spat out a jet of red liquid to the side. Then he told me to come back in 2 days. He must have phoned his man in Laxmangar, and then that man must have gone and spoken to Kusum, and asked the neighbors about us, and phoned back, "He's got a good family. They've never made any trouble. Father died some years ago of TB. He was a rickshaw puller. Brother is in Dhanbad too, a worker in the tea shops. No history of supporting Naxals or other terrorists, and they don't move about. We know exactly where they are."
That last piece of information was very important. They had to know where my family was at all times.
I have not told you yet, have I, about what the buffalo did to his domestic servant, the one who was supposed to guard his infant son, who got kidnapped by the Naxals and then tortured and killed. The servant was one of our caste, sir, a halwai. I had seen him once or twice when I was a boy.
The servant said he had nothing to do with the kidnapping. The buffalo did not believe him and got 4 of his hired gunmen to torture the servant. Then they shot him through the head.
Fair enough. I would do the same to someone who let my son get kidnapped.
But then
Because the buffalo was sure that the man had deliberately let the child be kidnapped for money, he also went after the servant's family. One brother was set upon while working in the fields, beaten to death there. That brother's wife was finished off by three men working together. A sister, still unmarried, was also finished off. Then the house where the family had lived was surrounded by the four henchmen and set on fire. Now who would want this to happen to his family, sir? Which inhuman wretch of a monster would consign his own granny and brother and aunt and nephews and nieces to death? The stork and his sons could count on my loyalty. When I came back, the Nepali guard opened the gate without a word. I was inside the compound now. As far as masters go, Mr. Ashok, Mukesh Seer, and the stork were better than 9 in 10. There was always enough food in the house for the servants. On Sundays you even got a special dish, rice mixed with small red chunks of boneless chicken. I had never had a regular chicken dish in my life until then. It made you feel like a king, eating chicken Sunday after Sunday and then licking your fingers. I had a covered room to sleep in. True, I had to share it with the other driver, a grim-looking fellow named Ram Persad, and he had the nice big bed while I had to sleep on the floor. Still, a covered room's a covered room, and much nicer than sleeping on the road, as Kishan and I had been doing all the time we were in Dhanbad. Above all, I got the thing that we who grow up in the darkness value most of all. A uniform. A khaki uniform. The next day, I went to the bank, the one that had a wall made all of glass. I saw myself reflected in the glass panes, all in khaki. I walked back and forth in front of that bank a dozen times, just gaping at myself. If only they had given me a silver whistle, I would have been in paradise. Kishan came once a month to see me. Kusum had decided that I could keep 90 rupees a month for myself. The rest would go straight to Kishan, who would send it straight to her in the village. I gave him the money every month through the black bars of the rear gate, and we would talk for a few minutes before the Nepali shouted, "That's enough! The boy has work to do now." The work of a number two driver was simple. If the number one driver, Ram Persad, was busy driving the masters around town in the Honda city, and someone in the house wanted to go to the market or to a coal mine or to the train station, I got into the Maruti Suzuki and drove them there. Otherwise, I had to stay around the house and make myself useful. Now, I say they took me on as their driver. I don't exactly know how you organize your servants in China, but in India, or at least in the darkness, the rich don't have drivers, cooks, barbers, and tailors. They simply have servants. What I mean is that any time I was not driving the car, I had to sweep the floor of the courtyard, make tea, clean cobwebs with a long broom, or chase a cow out of the compound. There was one thing I was not allowed to do, and this was to touch the Honda city. Ram Persad alone had the right to drive it and clean it. In the evenings I'd watch him wash the sleek exterior of the car with a soft cloth, and I'd burn with envy. I could see, even from outside, that this was a beautiful modern car, with all the necessary comforts, a speaker system, AC, nice glossy leather seats, and a big stainless steel spittoon in the back. It must be like paradise to drive such a nice car. All I had was a battered old Maruti Suzuki. One evening, as I was watching, Mr. Ashok came and poked his nose around the car. I was discovering that he was a very inquisitive man. "What's that for? That shiny thing in the back?"
"Spittoon, sir."
"What?" Ram Persad explained. The spittoon was for the stork, who liked to chew paan. If he spat the paan out the window, the paan might streak the sides of the car. So he spat near his feet, into the spittoon, which the driver washed and cleaned at the end of every ride. "Disgusting," Mr. Ashok said. He was asking about something else when Mukesh Seer's son Roshan came running up to us with the plastic-patterned ball in his hand. Ram Persad snapped his fingers for me. Playing cricket with any brat in the household who wanted to play, and letting him win handsomely, was one of the prescribed duties of driver number two. Mr. Ashok joined the game. He stood as the wicket-keeper while I bowled full tosses to the bread.
"I'm Azharuddin, captain of India,"
the boy shouted every time he hit a six or a four.
"Call yourself Gavaskar. Azharuddin is a Muslim."
It was the stork. He had come into the courtyard to watch.
Mr. Ashok said, "Father, what a silly thing to say. Hindu or Muslim, what difference does it make?"
"Oh, you young people and your modern ideas," the stork said. He put his hands on me. "I have to steal the driver, Roshan. I'm sorry. You'll have him back in an hour, okay?"
The stork had a special use for driver number two. He had bad legs with blue veins in them, and had been told by a doctor to sit in the courtyard in the evening with his feet in warm water and have them massaged by a servant. I had to heat water on the stove, carry it into the courtyard, and then lift the old man's feet up one after the other, and immerse them in the hot water, and then massage them both gently. As I did this, he would close his eyes and moan. After half an hour, he would say, "The water's gone cold," and then I had to lift his feet out, one at a time, from the bucket, and carry the bucket into the toilet. The water in it was dark, dead hair and bits of skin floated on it. I had to fill the bucket with fresh, hot water and bring it back. As I was massaging, the two sons pulled up chairs and sat down by their father to talk. Ram Prasad would bring out a bottle full of a golden liquid and pour it into three glasses and drop ice cubes in their glasses and hand one glass to each of them. The sons would wait for the father to take the first sip and say, "Ah, whiskey, how would we survive this country without it?" And then the talking would start. The more they talked, the faster I massaged. They talked about politics, coal, and about your country, China. Somehow these things, politics, coal, China, were linked to the family fortunes of the stork. And dimly I understood that my own fate, since I was part of this family now, was linked into these three things as well. The chatter of coal and China got mixed up with the aroma of whiskey from the glasses, the stench of sweat rising up from the stork's feet dipped in the warm water, the flakiness of his skin, and the light jabs of the sandal feet of Mr. Ashok or the mongoose when they bumped into my back in the process of moving about. I absorbed everything. That's the amazing thing about entrepreneurs. We are like sponges. We absorb and grow. A sharp blow landed on my head. I looked up and saw the stork, with his palm still raised over my skull, glaring at me. "Know what that was for?" "Yes, sir," I said, with a big smile on my face.
"Good." A minute later, he hit me on the head again.
"Tell him what it was for, father."
"I don't think he knows."
"Fellow, you're pressing too hard. You're too excited. Father is getting annoyed. Slow down."
"Yes, sir." "Do you have to hit the servants, father?"
"This is not America, son. Don't ask questions like that."
"Why can't I ask questions?"
"They expect it from us, Ashok. Remember that. They respect us for it."
Now, Pinky Madam never joined in these conversations, except to play badminton with Ram Prasad, which she did wearing dark glasses. She never left her room. I wondered what was going on with her. Was she having a fight with her husband? Was he not sticking it to her well in bed? When the stork said, "The water's gone cold," for the second time, and took his feet out of the bucket, my work was done. I splashed the cold water down the sink. I washed my hands for 10 minutes, and dried them and washed them again, but it made no difference. No matter how much you wash your hands after you have massaged a man's foot, the smell of his old, flaky skin will stay on your skin for an entire day. There was only one activity that servant number one and servant number two had to do together. At least once a week, around 6 o'clock, Ram Prasad and I left the house and went down the main road, until we got to a store with a sign that said, "Jackpot English Liquor Shop. Indian-made foreign liquor sold here." I should explain to you, Mr. Jabbao, that in this country we have two kinds of men,
Indian liquor men and English liquor men. India liquor was for village boys like me, toddy, arak, country hooch. English liquor, naturally, is for the rich, rum, whiskey, beer, gin, anything the English left behind. Is there a Chinese liquor, Mr. Premier? I'd love to take a sip. One of the most important duties of driver number one was to come to Jackpot once a week and buy a bottle of the most expensive whiskey for the stork and his sons. It was part of servant protocol, though don't ask me why, that the junior driver accompany him on this outing. I guess I was supposed to make sure he did not run away with the bottle. Coloured bottles of various sizes were stacked up on Jackpot's shelves, and two teenagers behind the counter struggled to take orders from the men shouting at them. On the white wall to the side of the shop, there were hundreds of names of liquor brands, written in a dripping red paint and subdivided into five categories: beer, rum, whiskey, gin, and vodka. Price list, Jackpot English Liquor Shop. Our whiskey. Whiskey, first class. Whiskey, second class. Whiskey, third class. Even cheaper whiskey is available. Ask at the counter. Our vodka? Vodka, first class. It was a small store, and at least 50 men were crammed into the 10 feet of space in front of the counter, each yelling at the top of his voice, while waving rupee notes of the higher denominations. Kingfisher Strong, 1 liter. Old Monk, half bottle. Thunderbolt, Thunderbolt. They were not going to be drinking this liquor. I could tell from their torn and dirty shirts that they were only servants like Ram Persad and me, come to buy English liquor for their masters. If we came after 8 o'clock on a weekend night to Jackpot, it was like a civil war in front of the counter. I had to keep the men at bay, while Ram Persad shoved his way to the counter and yelled, Black Dog, full bottle! Black Dog was the first name in the first-class category of whiskey. It was the only thing that the stork and his sons drank. Ram Persad would get the liquor, and then I would swat at the other servants and fight for some space for us to get out, while he cradled the bottle in his arms. It was the only time we were ever like a team. On our way back to the house, Ram Persad would always stop by the side of the road and slide the Black Dog out of its cardboard box. He said this was to check that Jackpot hadn't cheated us. I knew he was lying. He just wanted to hold the bottle. He wanted to hold the full virgin bottle of first-class whiskey in his hand. He wanted to imagine that he was buying it for himself. Then he would slide the bottle back into the cardboard box and return to the house, me behind him, my eyes still dazzled by the sight of so much English liquor. At night, while Ram Persad snored from his bed, I lay on the floor with my head resting on my palms. I was staring at the ceiling, and thinking how the stork's two sons were as different from each other as night and day. Mukesh Sir was small and dark and ugly and very shrewd. We would have called him the Mongoose back at home. He had been married for some years to a homely wife who was turning fat on schedule after having 2 children, both boys. This fellow, this Mongoose, did not have his father's body, but he had his father's mind. If he ever saw me waste even 1 moment, he would shout, Driver, don't loiter there, clean the car. Cleaned it already, sir. Then take a broom and sweep the courtyard. Mr. Ashok had his father's body. He was tall and broad and handsome, like a landlord's son should be. In the evenings, I saw him play badminton with his wife in the compound of the house. She wore pants. I gaped. Who had ever seen a woman dressed in trousers before, except in the movies? I assumed at first she was an American, one of those magical things he had brought home from New York, like his accent and the fruit-flavored perfume he put on his face after shaving. 2 days later, Ram Persad and the slanty-eyed Napoli were gossiping. I took a broom, began sweeping the courtyard, and edged closer and closer to them. She's a Christian, did you know? No way. Yes. And he married her? They married in America. When we Indians go there, we lose all respect for caste,
the Nepali said. The old man was dead set against the marriage. Her people were not happy either.
So, how did it happen?
The Nepali glared at me.
Hey, are you eavesdropping on us?
No, sir.